Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King joins us. We'll ask him about Hillary Clinton, who seems to be making all the right moves for someone who just might want to run for president again. Then Peter Galzinis, Boston Herald columnist who's born, bred, and still living down the street from Whitey Bulger's South Boston killing zone. He'll analyze yesterday's verdict. David Frank from Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly will tell us what's left legally for Bulger and the families who said they were denied justice yesterday.
All right, Marjorie, then we'll hear from someone who testified at the trial. Retired head of the Massachusetts State Police, Tom Foley, says the FBI undermined all his attempts to bring Whitey to justice. Then the father of Ibrahim Todashev, that friend of the Tsarnaev shot to death in Florida, is speaking out about what happened. And later, new music with Edgar B. Herwick III and the Boston Globe's Sarah Rodman. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. She is Emily Rooney from Greater Boston, filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie.
This is Boston Public Radio. Okay. Is Hillary Clinton making all the right moves for a 2016 election? Will the president back up Eric Holder, the attorney general, for real on his drug sentencing plans? And what about the vacationing Obamas? Have you heard about Bogate?
Bogate, love it.
As in the family dog, Bo Obama. We're going to talk about all those things.
He got a ride on a helicopter, we should just say.
He did get a ride on the helicopter. That's right. He didn't steal anything as far as we know. There's no sex scandal involving Bogate, the family dog. Get on the record about that. But there is a mini scandal about how little Bo got over to Martha's Vineyard. We're going to ask all those questions, as we do every Tuesday, of John King of CNN's chief national correspondent. Hello, John.
Those are, you know, taxpayer-funded M&Ms, presidential aircraft. So Darryl Issa is going to have to investigate this, I think.
Yeah. Well, little Bo did come over on a separate aircraft. Apparently, some airline.
One of those giant helicopters that can take a fleet of cars.
Yeah.
With it.
It takes off like a helicopter and
flies
like a plane. That's kind of
cool. Osprey, yeah, that's how the Ospreys take off. I saw some of those. I was actually on the vineyard for the week before the president, and I saw them doing some training exercises. And I also saw some Chinooks, which are the older Navy helicopters.
These are bigger than Chinooks.
Right.
Well, the Drudge Report made a big deal about this, John, but we understand that the White House claims that not only was the Portuguese water dog Bo on the on this fancy-dancy aircraft, but also White House staff and some members of the media. Do you know anything about what actually happened?
I don't know the exact details, but I do know this. Presidents go on vacation. Presidents have families and presidents have pets. And some people don't like it because it is an expensive taxpayer dollars, and they think, why do we have to pay for all this security? We hear about it on their vacations. The Democrats used to scream about George W. Bush spends all this time in Crawford. Now some Republicans will scream, you know, Barack Obama's on Martha's Vineyard and his dog's getting special rides. My personal philosophy, having covered the White House for 8.5 years in both the Democratic and Republican administration, is you elect this guy to do one of the toughest jobs in the world. And with that comes the idea that when he goes on vacation, because of all the security involved in protecting a president, that stuff comes with the territory. Now, should somebody look at it, make sure it's not crazy? Of course. But when the president goes on vacation, where is he supposed to put his dog? In the kennel?
We're on board.
We love Bo Obama. We think he's just adorable.
What's the point of being the president? You can't put your dog on a helicopter.
And every president has at least one dog, if not two or three dogs, correct?
Yes.
Okay, we'll move on.
We've got to move on. So, John, we've got some excitement here coming to Boston. The RNC, as I'm sure you know, Republican National Committee, is having its summer meeting in Boston, which is kind of an odd choice, let's face it, since there are no Republicans here in statewide office. And some of the big names are coming, Chris Christie, not Mitt Romney. Scott Brown is going to be there. The theme of their meeting is going to be making it happen. So what do you think the signal is here, not inviting Mitt Romney?
Well, I'm assuming that there was Governor Romney, if he wanted to come, probably could have come and said hello, and maybe he'll talk to people if they're in town. One of the challenges for the party is to move on. And although Governor Romney wants to be influential in the party, he's still talking to his fundraisers about helping people in the party. If you ask me, you know, put him on Truth Serum, I bet he'd be more interested in a Chris Christie than, say, a Rand Paul or a Ted Cruz leading the pack next time. But the challenge for the party is to move on. And one of the ways to move on, even for all the respect a lot of Republicans have for Governor Romney, is he lost the last election, and he lost it pretty convincingly. And so the Republican Party has to turn the page and move on to the new generation. One of the panels they'll have in Boston is about how the majority in America is women. You know, the Republicans, they have a Latino problem. They have an African-American problem. They have a women problem. And increasingly, they have an elderly problem. The math right now for the Republican Party is getting worse, even since the last election, not better. And so it's a steep hill for the party, and they have to worry a lot more about whether or not Mitt Romney is coming to their meeting or not.
So, you know, with all these problems involving Hispanics, John King, it seems rather odd that this Iowa rep of Stephen King, the one who actually called immigrant children drug mules in rather despicable remark, is now running around the country with giving more speeches about immigration. He just gave one in Eric Cantor's backyard down there in Virginia, claiming societies become more violent as they move further south in Latin America. I mean, it couldn't be more hostile toward Hispanics. What are they going to do about this guy?
Well, they can't muzzle him, and he's going to South Carolina, and he's moving around. And this is one of the debates we're going to have in the party. And they're like Ryan Priebus, you're going to have him in Boston. Maybe you can get him to come on the program, or Emily, you can get him on your program.
All right.
He's an interesting guy, and he's a thoughtful guy. He can't muzzle these guys as much as he probably would like to muzzle some of them. And the challenge is who comes out as a bigger voice. But when you're out of power, look, the Democrats not on these issues, but the Democrats went through this after McGovern lost 49 states, after Mondale lost 49 states. You have a fight, you know, is the African-American base too strong? Are the labor unions too strong? How do we do this? How do we do that? It wasn't quite like this because these issues are out in the forefront. But look, there are parts of the Republican. Number one, he doesn't have to worry that much about his district back home. He survived a tough race last time. He thinks he's safe now. He thinks he can say these things. We'll see what the voters of his district back in Iowa think in the next election. But number two, there's a slice of the Republican Party that likes this talk, that wants this talk, that wants to fight what they consider amnesty, that wants to protect what they consider, you know, the quote-unquote American way. I'm not defending them, but I'm just saying that he is not doing this. If he were alone in doing this, if he had nowhere to go, a group to speak to, nobody, we wouldn't be talking about this. Mm-hmm. But it's a small slice in the party, but it is a vocal slice in the party that says amen to these things.
Well, it's interesting whether that will be a topic of discussion tomorrow when these meetings start that are going to be going all week through the rest of Friday. I know they have all these scheduled, planned events and topics, but this is an image issue, as is Jim DeMint, you know, with his kind of wild stuff at the Heritage Foundation. It's got to be on board for discussion.
Ryan Priebus is a very smart guy, and he helped bring the Republican Party back in Wisconsin, which has been a blue state. And so he knows the math. He knows the math. Now, he's a conservative. He's, you know, not as in the same place probably even as Marco Rubio or Barack Obama when it comes to immigration. But he knows election math. And privately, I know this from Speaker Boehner's office. I know this from Ryan Priebus' staff. Privately, they encourage Republicans all the time, you know, make your case on the policy. Watch the crazy language and watch the conspiracy theories. But again, some of these guys either don't quite get it or they just love the attention. And they know that the way to get on cable television or the way to get on talk radio is to say the most bizarre thing. And then once you say it, to get on next week, you got to top it.
Jeez, we know. We're talking with John King from CNN, and there's going to be the summer meeting at the Westin on the waterfront. I didn't know there was a Westin
on the
waterfront.
Oh, yeah. Is that one where you can't get a cab?
Oh, is that the one you can't?
New convention center, right?
Oh, okay. That Westin on the waterfront.
Location.
Okay, in South
yeah.
Boston.
Yeah.
Okay, I was a little confused about where this was. I was thinking it was
there a while.
The Marriott.
The Riviera.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's the new, beautiful South Boston waterfront area. But anyway, they're having this convention there. Not convention. They're going to have a get-together tomorrow in Boston that Mitt Romney's not invited to. So you mentioned John King from CNN, that the Republicans have a problem with women, Latinos, and the elderly. So what is the elderly issue? Is this that they have to fix?
We've just seen in recent polling, Stan Greenberg, now he's a Democrat, but he's a credible guy. He put out a poll recently showing that the favorability of the Republican Party is now falling among elderly voters as well. And the elderly vote in the last 10 or 15 years has been a critical piece of the Republican constituency. And some of it's Medicare and Social Security, some of it's language like that. But I think more and more this has just collectively become a tolerance and a confidence question. The people who are out there getting the attention like the Steve Kings, I'm sure there are, look, don't get me wrong, there are some elderly Americans who are staunchly opposed to any path to citizenship, who might agree when he calls it amnesty. So we have to be careful not to generalize. But when you travel the country or when you talk to people, the Asian American vote used to be a good Republican constituency, small business, new Americans, low taxes, pro-business. Look how they voted in the last two elections. It's a tolerance thing. The Republican Party increasingly sounds like the white guy's party.
Yeah.
The old white guy's party.
The old angry white guy's party.
So I think there's a question of tolerance and there's a question of confidence. And part of it is being the party out of power.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, John, you've got Hillary Rodham Clinton in San Francisco talking to the American Bar Association, saying that, she's one of these people who believes that nobody should have to be issued a voter ID. So she's saying voter rights is one of the big issues in Washington right now. And she says, I'm going to take on these big issues, for the next couple years or whatever it is, maybe marching down to 2016. I was one of these people, and still am, convinced that she's not going to run. But this is the kind of thing that gives me pause. Here she is. She's starting on this issue. She's going to go to others.
Well, if she runs, she's going to say that I've been out there on the big issues for the last couple of years. And look, she's playing with us a little bit, and I don't mean that critically. I mean, that's the way it works. She can wait as late as anybody to decide for sure. Most people in this town think she is going to run, that she's going to find the argument just too overwhelming, that she's such a prohibitive favorite for the Democratic nomination, and that at least as of this conversation today, the Republican Party still has a dysfunction problem, and so that the Democratic nominee, especially if it's her, will have a great chance to be president. So, number one, look, she was the first lady of Arkansas, which is a state that has dealt with voting rights and civil rights and, the Little Rock schools. And so she has a history on these issues, number one. So she can say, whether or not I run for president, these are important issues, and I want to get out and I want to be part of the national debate, which is fine. Number two, though, if she runs for president, I mean, one of the big questions in the next Democratic primary, with Barack Obama removed from the scene, if you do not have an African-American candidate, and even if you do have an African-American candidate, where does that vote go? In Iowa and New Hampshire, mostly white, predominantly white states, but then you move on. The Democratic parties go through several states, South Carolina, and then on into Georgia in the south and up into Illinois, where the African-American constituency is the most important part. North Carolina, which just imposed its new voter ID law, the Republican governor just signed it. Another state where the African-American population with, think back to 2008. I mean, Hillary Clinton started early on with a lot of institutional African-American support. It then swayed, to then Senator Obama as he proved he was a credible candidate. But she has a history with this group, but it's going to be, it's very clear she's laying the mark that if I run, I want your vote, and I'm not going to wait till 2016 to prove that I care about the issues you want to fight for right now.
Well, there was a great little piece, I think it might have been Politico, talking about how she says she's going down to Philadelphia next month to talk about the balance and transparency necessary in our national security policies. And this is obviously a reaction to the whole NSA spying thing. And then she's going to talk about later in the fall, she's got the whole fall mapped out, how she's going to address these implications, the implications of these issues for America's global leadership and moral standing in the world, blah, blah, blah. So it does seem, and plus the Clinton Foundation, which was just her husband's. Now it's going to be, it's kind of nice, actually. It's going to be
a family affair.
It's going to be renamed for Hillary and Bill and Chelsea, the whole bunch of them together. So between that and the fall all mapped out, I mean, I'm not comparing Hillary Clinton to Sarah Palin. We know she kept us waiting forever about whether she was going to run last time around by giving these speeches all around the country. So it's not dissimilar, at least in strategy, than that if she's not going to run. But boy, it does sure look like, why would you spend
$250,000 a pop for one, probably.
Well, that's it. You get a lot of money for these. Could the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia pay her a lot of money? John King from CNN, what do you think?
I don't know any different. Some speeches she'll give for free. Others she will make six figures without a doubt. There's no question about that. And, she's allowed to do that. And some people will roll their eyes at that. Remember when she was in the Senate and then former President Clinton was giving speeches around the world, taking money from big oil countries and the likes and big corporations. A lot of people rolled their eyes about that and said, is there a conflict here? So whatever she does will become part of the debate and the discussion should she decide to run for office again. She's also working on a book. But look, she has any national platform she wants, and she, in fact, has an international platform. And don't be surprised if you see her next year travel the world a little bit after her book is done, and to get out with part of the Clinton Foundation, maybe do some things overseas. And part of it is she wants to be part of the debate. We're cynical in politics sometimes, and we think everything's about 2016. I think a lot of it is about being in position to run. Should she decide in the end, yes, I'm going to run. There's no question about that. Unlike Sarah Palin, who was always teasing this issue but never had an infrastructure in place to raise money or to put a campaign organization in place. Clinton has that.
That's a great point.
Yeah, that's a great point. I can't help but get out of the back of my head, though, that she had that, you know, health scare. And, of course, that would come back and dog her.
Point, I think it's a great point. I think that she's going to have to, you know, convince herself, look, running for president, it's great for the ego if you win. She lost. She's a competitive person. Number one of the reasons I think she will run is because she's a proud, competitive person and she lost. And she wants to win. She wants to end on a high note. But she understands how grueling it is, both from her husband's campaigns and her campaign, and from watching this president. Even in a campaign in which you're heavily favored, President Obama had to fight for this one last time. He didn't have a primary, which was a great luxury for the Democrats last time. But it is a grueling process to do Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. Now would she have a ton of competition in the Democratic primary? We don't know. But history also tells you that after an eight-year presidency of one party, the other party tends to win. George H.W. Bush is the only Republican in our lifetime to succeed a two-term president, is the only person in our lifetime to succeed a two-term president.
And then he only had one term.
Right, he only had one term. Now, again, I think that, look, we all remember this Massachusetts folks, the Dukakis campaign and the mistakes they made, but the Bush campaign also ran a really good campaign. The Republican Party is not in the good shape now, as it was coming out of Reagan years. I mean, that's just a fact. And that's one of the draws on Hillary Clinton, has to be that the Republicans, at least as of now, it's a long time between now and 2016, but as of now, they're still in the circular firing squad.
We're talking with John King from CNN, as we do every Tuesday at noontime. John, you know, speaking of something that may have some agreement between the Republican Party for money reasons and the Democratic Party for other reasons, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, just outlined the sentencing reform on Monday in San Francisco, talking about reining in mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug offenses. And the money angle, of course, is this costs us billions and billions of dollars as it's exploded the prison population. And it's also mainly targeting black men who are make up a disproportionate percentage of the people in those prisons. So how hard does Obama fight for this? Or is this just, you know, the Attorney General saying something that pleases a lot of Democrats and it's not going to get far? And, you know, there is a sensitivity issue, too, of Barack Obama being the first black president and the high percentage of black men that are incarcerated. What does Obama do about this?
I think actually there's potential here, great potential here, for Washington to actually get something done. We often talk about the paralysis here, whether the issue is immigration, whether the issue is taxes, spending, or entitlement. This is an issue where you mentioned there's a very interesting coalition. You have Pat Leahy from Vermont, a liberal Democrat. He has the Senate Judiciary Committee. This has been one of his pet peeves and concerns for a long time. Eric Holder says he and the president have been talking about this for years as a policy matter and also because of the points you made about the disproportionate number of African-American males. And they have Rand Paul, the libertarian who's conservative Republican who's running for president in 2016 already. He's out there and active, who thinks the president's dead right on this and issued a very strong statement yesterday saying, I want to work with the Attorney General and the administration on this. For the points you made, it's a fascinating, you know, there are odd coalitions in Washington are fun to watch. And there are the Democrats who say, you know, these mandatory minimums are just, they say, stupid. They're too rigid. They tie the hands of judges, and the prosecutors and the judges have no leeway. So you have somebody who's a first offender who maybe didn't do anything, you know, terribly bad, who maybe belongs in rehab and in a good probation program, but not in a prison, where for most people like that, things get worse, not better. And the conservatives saying, look at states like California, look at the federal system. This is costing us billions. It's costing us billions, and we don't have the money, so let's try to do something that makes more sense. So I actually do think this is one where this odd coalition may bring some progress in a town that has forgotten what progress is.
Well, John, what are they going to do? Are they going to revoke the law? Because Eric Holder was saying we're going to ask prosecutors to no longer invoke the law. Well, that's completely different than changing it.
Well, unless you get some of these laws are on the books and Congress would have to change them. The Justice Department has some leeway in sentencing recommendations to judges. They also have some leeway in what they charge people with. You can pick a different charge,
True.
A lesser charge, charge them with something else so that you don't charge them with something where the judge has no choice because you have a mandatory minimum. However, that would only deal, the Justice Department has the flexibility to deal with some of this, not all of this. To get it completely changed, you would need the Congress to do something. And I do think you see the support in the Senate for this. You would probably have more of a fight in the conservative Republican-led House of Representatives. But there is a growing coalition here. And it is interesting. The question will be, will some Republicans decide to pull the soft on crime card, which Republicans traditionally have used against Democrats? We saw this with Willie Horton in the Dukakis campaign. And then we saw Bill Clinton, remember, flying home from New Hampshire. I was on the trip where he landed in West Memphis, Arkansas, to sign the death warrant for Billy Ray Rector, I think the guy's name was, because the governor of Arkansas doesn't have the power when he's out of state. He had to go back to the state to sign it. Because that was Bill Clinton saying, I'm tough on crime. Are we past that chapter? I don't know if we are, but when you see a Rand Paul saying, attaboy, Mr. President, I want to work with you on this, that tells you this is different.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, I hope so, because it's ridiculous. It is so ridiculous, money-wise, to be spending all this money on low-level drug offenders who are not violent, not attached to gangs, et cetera. But, John, we could have asked you this before when we were talking about the Republican Party and their various difficulties. But this is another one. You know, this whole thing about the conservative and Tea Party members threatening to shut down the government to prevent funding Obamacare. I guess Karl Rove is saying this is a terrible idea, awful idea. What's likely to happen here? This would be in the fall again when it comes to putting money into Obamacare. And we learned today that there's going to be more delays in implementing Obamacare. But are we really facing this shutdown, or is this just a lot of talk?
It is possible. I talked to somebody in the speaker's office the other day about this. I said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think the likelihood of a shutdown is, 10 being yes, a shutdown? They said probably between 2 and 3. They don't think so. They think in the end they cut a deal. Look, there are some Republicans who want to keep fighting this fight over Obamacare. And the leadership is saying, pass the Congress, it passed the Supreme Court test. We can keep voting in the House to repeal it. But the Democrats control the Senate. We have a Democratic president of the United States. It's not going to happen. And, you know, this is why we have elections. If you want to repeal Obamacare, take your case to the American people and see if you win. And the Republicans have tried that, and they've kept the House, and that's one of the reasons they keep wanting to talk about this, because they can argue, we did argue this in the 2010 and the 2012 election, and we kept our majority, therefore our people want us to do this. That doesn't mean the country wants them to do this. The Republican base wants them to do this. And there is a look, if you look at the polling, the country is still pretty divided. And as Obamacare gets implemented, you mentioned some of the problems and some of the delays. There are going to, when you try to change something so big, there inevitably are going to be hiccups. So the Republicans see an opening here to keep at this politically. But their leadership thinks threatening to shut down the government is not the right card to play. That doesn't mean that people like Marco Rubio, watch the dynamics of this. Marco Rubio, the conservative base, is mad at him on immigration because he wants to pass the citizenship. So now he's saying, let's stand and fight, shut down the government if necessary to defund Obamacare. He wants to take the lead on new abortion regulations. Well, part of that is the elasticity. You know, he's getting stretched one way by the right, so he's trying to make them happy by doing some other things.
Yeah, and then you got this, as I mentioned earlier, Jim DeMint, who's the former senator, and now he's the head of the Heritage Foundation, kind of end-running everybody, going around the country, holding these town meetings. And he says things that I don't know how you prove things that people say, like telling older people that they're – or young people, actually, that their premiums, the current health care premiums, are going to double or triple, and that they'll even go quadruple for the elderly. I mean, how do you, you know, put a finger in that? I don't know. Maybe it's true. I have no idea.
You know, his think tank has made conservative studies where they say that will happen, and there are liberal think tanks who say something else will happen. What we've seen so far, the evidence we've seen so far is somewhat mixed. We've seen states like New York and some other states where they've started to put these exchanges together, and they think their rates will actually go down in some states, and some states down significantly. In other places, we've seen that, you know, they say that when we do it in our state because of our demographics, they might go up a little bit. So I think this is going to play out on a state-by-state basis, and I think the delays, in some ways, when you're trying to do something so big, maybe taking your time is the right approach. Politically, they give Republicans the opening to say, we told you this wasn't going to work, and they're going to keep the fight. But the thing about Jim DeMint is our politics are increasingly decided in primaries because so few, especially at the House level, so few House districts are now competitive that you have Jim DeMint. Essentially, he knows this, so he's trying to scare House Republicans. Mm-hmm. Into thinking, if we don't stand with him on this, someone's going to primary us. And Jim DeMint is capable of raising money, and his friends are capable of raising money, and I might lose a primary. Most of these districts, whether you're Democrat or Republican, your district is safe. The only way to get beat is by somebody in your own party.
All right, so, John, as a one-time Boston boy, we got to get your reaction to the Whitey Bulger verdict yesterday. I know it's kind of our backyard, but it was also the front page of the New York Times, so it is a national story.
It is a national story because it's such a fascinating drama. And You know, as someone who grew up in Dorchester in the 70s and 80s when Whitey was a player and was a factor, and I remember my dad telling us stories about Whitey, and I know some of the bars in Dorchester where Whitey's guys had some business, shall we say. and I knew some kids from Southie who knew Whitey a little better than I did or knew Whitey's people better than I did. It's hard to believe that this book might actually be ending, that this saga has a final chapter, because this was the story that was never going to end and the guy that was never going to be found. And there he is sitting there, you know, he thinks it's a horrible trial. He thinks he was, you know, it was a sham, but he's guilty and he's done.
Yeah. Yesterday, John, I was down after the verdict at Strega Waterfront, a restaurant there where a CNN crew was filming for a documentary. All the families were in, not all the families, but many of the families were in one big long banquet table at this restaurant. Steve Davis, whose sister Deborah was murdered, the Donahues, whose the father was murdered, all these people, McGonagall's, Leonard's, all there, and the CNN crew, and they were filming the sort of post-verdict breaking bread with all these families. When is this documentary going to come out, John King?
I don't know the exact date, but it's our new film unit, documentary unit, working on some things. And hopefully when we talk next Tuesday, I'll have a date for you. But I know they're working on it. And this is one of the ones they'll try to turn around relatively quickly because of the story being in the news. Some of these things are evergreen. But look, this is a great drama. When I was first in Rhode Island working for the AP right out of college, and we covered the Patriarca family. And then there was the Gotti family. And there was the Angiulo family. And we don't hear as much about organized crime and these gangs as we used to. And part of that is technology has changed. Part of that is law enforcement has changed, how all this stuff works. But this is, you know, there's a reason The Sopranos did so well on HBO. Yeah. These cops, and there's a reason cops and robber dramas do so well on television. People love these kind of stories. And so often they're fiction. Well, this wasn't fiction. I mean, I read every day. I went online every day to read The Globe and The Herald and anything else I could read about this trial. And this because it's riveting stuff, and it's one of the, you know, as a TV guy now, I'm an old print guy, but it's like, this is one of the arguments for cameras in the federal courthouse. I would have loved to have seen some of this in the real world.
Don't get us going on that. we got going on that every day, John.
Yeah, we're sort of obsessed.
More than obsessed.
Federal judges would tell you no thank you.
Well, the Congress has the opportunity to change that if they want. All right, John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. Thanks so much for joining us. We check in with him every Tuesday at noon. Thanks, John.
Take care.
All right, now that the jurors have had their say, what unanswered questions remain in the aftermath of the Whitey Bulger verdict? Boston Herald's Peter Galzinis joins us next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Dorm rooms and bunk beds, communal bathrooms, oh no thank you. It's tanning beds and indoor theaters for these college kids.
The increased building of these upscale communities surrounding college campuses sort of falls in with the trend of what some people have called the country clubization of college.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Student housing goes upscale next time on Marketplace. It's from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Welch and Forbes, celebrating 175 years of serving as wealth advisors to New England families. Welch and Forbes, knowing wealth, knowing you. On the web at welchforbes.com. And the Westin Copley Place. You can relax in their newly renovated guest rooms or dine on fresh local seafood at Turner Fisheries Restaurant. More information at turnersboston.com and westincopleyplaceboston.com/SIC.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Joining us is Boston Herald columnist Peter Galzinis, who's been covering the Whitey Bulger trial. And not only that, he has an advantage because he has lived in South Boston his entire life. Thank you for being with us here today, Peter Galzinis.
Hey, Peter. It's Emily Rooney.
Hello.
So I stumbled into that interview last night on WBZ TV. I guess he was also on this juror from the Whitey Bulger trial was also on Dan Ray last night, but I was watching BZ at 11. It was riveting. This is juror number 5, Scott Hodicky, and really got into the details of the deliberations and what it was like in there. Here's just a little bit of what he had to say.
There was all kinds of, like, dissension. It was heated. People slamming doors, people leaving, people wanting to get off the jury.
Interesting, too, Peter Scott Hodecky said that he wanted to vote guilty right away. And there were people who were absolute holdouts and said absolutely not, you know. And then there were people who forgot what the testimony was. You can understand it.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, it's, well, 7 weeks and a myriad of stuff, you know, and a lot of different players, you know. So, yeah, and, you know...
Okay, he was convicted on not all the murders, most of the murders yesterday, and everything else. So is there a takeaway here? Is this great victory for the government? Is it not a great victory for the government? Is it a lot of families are very upset they didn't get the proven of guilty of murder that they wanted in the Leonards and the...
I always thought it was going to be a messy situation. I mean... It's a messy story, you know. It's a schizophrenic story in many respects, too, because, you know, the government is, in this situation, the government is making the claim that he was an informant. He was a government informant. And yet, you know, all of the stuff that Weeks, Flemmy, Monterano said, they had said in a lot of previous trials, civil trials, where, you know, lawyers came up from the Department of Justice to block the idea that, you know, they essentially conceded that, okay, he may have been an informant, but, you know, you're too late. You can't sue us. You can't sue the government. So, you know, it's, you've got this, and the defense, I think, did a very, very good job in extracting that. You know, people talked about the fact, well, they're conceding so much. They're conceding a lot of different murders, the older murders and stuff. But they did mine that area, that kind of very messy, schizophrenic area where the government had a hand in enabling this guy.
Yep.
And I think you see that in I mean, I think, you know, regardless of what kind of dissension and fighting went on in there, they did come out, I think, with an accurate reflection of what this case is about. I mean, the notion that, you know, they were going to run out. I mean, I don't think everybody knew that he was going to be found guilty. That wasn't the point. The point is, what were they going to say about this case in total and how, you know, incestuous and messy it was.
Yeah. I mean, this juror said point blank to BZ last night that they wanted to send the government a message, and they did. I mean, and we saw yesterday, you saw the victims' families hugging the defense
right,
team
exactly.
For making the same point.
We heard last week when the first sort of eruption out of the jury room, I mean, we heard about this eruption and the speculation.
Do we know what that was about?
Well, the speculation that was buzzing around, the first speculation was that you had a fierce anti-government person who was basically saying it was almost like the Mattapan massacre all over again. I'm not going to deliberate. You know, the government's guilty on this. I mean, that was the buzz. But then they went back to deliberation. But it was really whipping around the courthouse that somebody had just decided, you know, the government is responsible. You know,
so. We're talking with Peter Gelsenes from the Boston Herald, who covered the Whitey Bulger trial from beginning to end. You have a column today that interviews one of the sons of the do you know the Wheeler column, the kid from Oklahoma whose father was killed?
David Wheeler.
Yes. His father was killed, and he was a legitimate businessman. He was involved in the highlight business, but a legitimate businessman. His son wants an investigation of the FBI, and he's totally disgusted by the FBI.
Well, their resentment goes much deeper than even the Bulger situation because, you know, the father was really doomed by Paul Rico. Rico again is the fellow who was the role model, if you will, for John Conley when he was here, but he winds up down there as head of security for World Highlight, and basically kind of, you know, opens the door for the whole Winter Hill sort of infection to set in down there. And Wheeler found this out afterwards. You know, I mean, they found out that their father was essentially, you know, surrounded by in the in Wheeler, the old man, the father, had tremendous respect for the FBI. He thought that because Rico was a former FBI agent,
he was a great guy.
He was the best person to run the security for the World High Line.
Yeah.
And what you had was the wolf, you know, essentially guarding the chicken coop here. And so when all of that was revealed slowly, Wheeler is just, you know, Wheeler's feelings for the government, in particular the FBI, are, and he was another one. He was another one who was essentially shut out of any kind of compensation because of the technicality. You're too late.
And here's his father, his father coming out from a golf game on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon in Monterano. John Monterano, the guy that confessed to 20 years in jail and gets a 12-year sentence, comes over and basically blasts him.
Between the eyes.
Right, in his car, in the parking lot, in broad daylight.
And that's an important part, I think, of the verdict that has to be stated, is the fact that the jury got that. The jury got this weird situation of people who got the deals. You know, they understood, I think, that, you know, Monterano had to carry this message in. But then again, you know, the idea of why isn't he in jail? And Ortiz had to say that herself yesterday out in front of the courthouse. You know, she had to admit that. And she had to admit, you know, do I think he should be in jail? Of course I do. And yet, you know, so I think this is part of the message. I heard that when Brian Kelly, one of the prosecutors, came out, you know, one of the first things he said to people who were within earshot was they did not like John Monterano.
Who, the jury?
The jury.
Not. Yeah, well, we actually have that piece of sound.
Yeah. This is Scott Hodaki again talking about John Monterano. That's not it.
There was one juror that constantly said that, you know, Monterano, his testimony was not believable over and over again, that you couldn't believe anything they said. Because of the government.
And that, of course, refers to the fact that the government made this horrible deal, I think, with John Monterano, 12 years in jail for confessing to 20 murders. Other people would say that if John Monterano had not confessed and not gotten this deal from the government, enabling them to go after Whitey Bulger, he wouldn't have had this trial.
And there's truth to that. I mean, the thing is, you know, we've built up Bulger as this kind of devil incarnate who you know, kind of oversaw everything. And the reality is that you know, he was, you know, intertwined with a lot of other people and players. You know, and I think that comes out. And I mean, obviously, the fact that he was enabled ultimately by the government. But you wouldn't get you wouldn't get to where this was sort of broken open without the testimony of without the, you know, the briefings of Monterano, Weeks, and Fleming.
By the way, that same juror said that he wanted to vote guilty on Deborah Davis. He said he absolutely believed that Whitey Bulger killed Deborah Davis, but he had to compromise and pull that one off the table just to get to the point where they could agree on a verdict. So there was a lot of that kind of swapping.
And the variable there was the fact that you didn't have Weeks at that situation. You know, you had Weeks at Hussey. But
Kevin Weeks, who said that
right.
Bulger was the killer of
Hussey.
Yeah, Kevin
Weeks sort of
Kevin
standing
Weeks was
there
not
watching
there
this,
to
right.
say that Whitey Bulger was the killer of Deborah Davis. And it was interesting. I was mentioning before that I was at this after the verdict get-together of the families at a restaurant next to the courthouse. And Stephen Davis said there repeatedly that he was never sure that Whitey Bulger, hands-on, put his hands around the neck of his sister and strangled her, leaving one to assume that he thought Flemmy did it. And Stephen Flemmy, of course, had been the longtime boyfriend of Deborah Davis. And Deborah Davis, a much younger woman, was about to leave Flemmy for another man. And it might have been partly that she had a big mouth, which is supposedly the reason why she went, and partly the plain old lover's rage.
Right. Right.
So Davis, although he was disappointed because he thought it was a joint venture, his line to me was, well, if you go in to rob a bank, you know, and somebody gets shot, everybody who's there gets
well,
convicted.
Well, the idea supposedly that Bulger urged that she be done away with.
Right.
But, you know, I've known Steve for 15 years or more, and when I watched him yesterday, I was standing outside and I watched him at the microphones. I couldn't help thinking that he's gone through this evolution too, because when they brought, I was sent down to Tulsa when Flemmy was essentially brought into the courtroom to confess to everything. And he was brought in the courtroom up here, and then he was flown down to Tulsa. But they sent me down to Tulsa. But I had heard that when he came into the Moakley courthouse for that,
Fleming.
Yeah, Steve just exploded. They had to carry Steve out of the courtroom. He was just, you know, he just couldn't take it.
When who came into the courtroom?
Fleming.
Oh, and
when Fleming came in, and of course he.
Oh, Steve, you know, Davis exploded.
Steve Davis.
Okay.
I mean, Davis just was volcanic, and he was just, you know, all of this rage had just exploded, and they literally had to take him out. And when they first caught Whitey, I called him up, and he was torn about whether he was going to go, because he said, I don't know if I'll be able to handle it. I just don't know if I'll be able to handle it. Well, you know, he eventually, obviously, he was one of the stalwarts. He was there all the time. But I just, when I looked at him yesterday out there, he seemed very reflective and pensive about things. You know, I mean, grieving, but you know, not necessarily sort of, you know, clenched fist about the government or anything else. I mean, I think he, partly because obviously, you know, the whole family knew the situation with Fleming and the connection that went on for years. So I think they always felt that you know, it was Fleming even more so than Bulger.
You know, his mother, Stephen's, Deborah Davis's mother, used to call me all the time. This is years ago.
Olga.
She was still... And this is back when the murder was already history. And, you know, how many times can you retrench something? I wish now, of course, I had gotten her on the record and really dug into this. What did she know about their relationship? Did she approve of it? Did she not approve of it? I mean, he was an older guy, you know.
Well, she was how old when they began dating? She was like 18, 17.
17.
He met her in a jewelry store.
Right.
And he was then, what, in his late 30s?
Yeah.
Early 40s, I believe.
Early 40s. And, you know,
and
they knew he was a gangster.
And Stephen Davis has said to me, too, you know, look, I was, his phrase, I was on the street myself.
Yeah.
You know, so who were they to approve or disapprove of something their sister was doing when they were into some stuff themselves, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot of, you know, it was very interesting yesterday that some of the survivors of these terrible deaths, the daughter of Connors, that was Eddie Connors that was killed, talked about how her mother, after their father was killed, said, enough of this life, and we're going to try to turn away from this and build a different life for ourselves. Some people did that. The Donahues, of course, who were innocent all along, the father, it's Michael Donahue that was killed, leaving a widow and three young sons. She raised those sons by herself and is a very impressive woman, Patricia Donahue.
And, you know, I wondered, when I started thinking about how this was going to play out before the trial, I kind of wondered if they would be prepared for the fact that, you know, many of them were in the life.
Yeah.
You know, many of them were part of that life. And obviously, I thought that would be part of the rationale that, you know, why he didn't kill people who were outside that loop. But the interesting thing was, the defense was, in a way, so much more sensitive to, you know, I mean, the government would call in a victim and basically just get the biographical data. You know, when was the last time? Is this your loved one? When was the last time you saw them? I mean, they did that with Pat Donahue. And there was so much more she wanted to say.
Yes.
But they didn't really, the government didn't want to go into that. And Carney just was incredible with that. And
that,
I mean,
matters.
Just,
you know, that really matters,
yeah,
because this was their whole life shot to death literally in front of
and
them.
And you could see, you know, that there were questions Carney was trying to ask that Kelly would just jump up and object to, because, and Pat wanted to answer them.
Yeah.
And you know, it was really a fascinating, I mean, the turnaround and the way the defense could actually get more out. I mean, the whole idea of calling in, you know, victims, family members, was to, you know, mine that emotional thing supposedly for the government. But the defense got so much more out of it.
Another example of that was Teresa Barrett Bond. She was really annoyed that the prosecution kept referring to her father as Bucky.
Right.
She said that was his nickname.
Right.
That's not his name. You know, how dare you? So once again, even though they were trying to do the right thing by that, and he was one of them. I mean, he was a bank robber,
sure.
And you know, not say he didn't deserve to be murdered, but
We're talking with Peter Galzinas from the Boston Herald. If you guys want to call in and weigh in on your opinions on the Whitey Bulger verdict, we had 19 murders. He was convicted in 11 of them, not in all 19. And, of course, he was convicted in everything else having to do with racketeering and all the other shenanigans as being a gangster in Boston. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. You know, one of the things I wanted to mention, too, along the same lines of the victims' families. And William O'Brien, and you've been covering this for years, William O'Brien, his father was shot to death 4 days before William O'Brien Jr. was born. And as this guy spoke with me yesterday, he was full of anger. This had been 40 years waiting for this trial, his whole life waiting for this trial. And as he complained to me, his father got about a minute and a half in the whole, you know, his death. And you know, O'Brien was killed, and he was in the life as well. Mm. He was killed. He went to Linda May's in Dorchester, which is no longer there, to pick up a birthday cake for his 10-year-old daughter. And he's driving down Morrissey Boulevard when Monterano comes up beside him and blows him away. The intended target survived and testified in the trial. But to O'Brien, this was his whole life. And he said he never even got a call that they were going to talk about his father. He had to follow the proceedings on Twitter, and that's how he knew that they were going to discuss his father. And you just think,
well, and you know, your point about when we were talking earlier today about Connie Leonard,
another terrible story.
Yeah, and she's absolutely right. You know, how can you not? You know, given what happened, I mean, they find her husband's body in Tommy King's car. I mean, how do they think that happened?
Yeah, they convict Bulger of killing Tommy King.
Right.
Her father's bullet-ridden body with blood all over his teeth. I hate to be so gruesome, but that was the description she gave, and she was appalled to see that this picture went online. Her father winds up in the guy's car, and she says,
"Oh, yeah,
he walked to the car,
and then killed himself,
and they couldn't find him guilty." Mm. Let's take a few calls. Peter Galzinas from the Boston Herald is here. I'm Marjorie Egan. Emily Rooney is with us as well. Matt from Burlington, what do you think about the Bulger verdict?
Thanks for the call. Great discussion. I don't find it, any of it was too surprising. One of the things I feel like has been missing from the debate, and sorry if I missed, I've only been on for the first 15 minutes, is the government's culpability. Was there any wrongdoing on their part? And if there's things that further people that should be investigated, and I feel like the government got away with something.
I think they got away with something, too. Don't you think there should be an investigation of the FBI? But
the jury did say they were sending the government a message. That's one of the jurors said, which is why they didn't convict on all those counts.
And you know, the idea of this, you know, the government's role in this has been out there for a long time. Certainly it was there in John Conley's two trials. And people would say,
well, the FBI agent who's serving life now in prison.
The Whitey's handler you know, and people would say, make the point that, you know, he wasn't the only one that you had. And it was. I mean, I've listened to some of the former ASACs, which are special agents in charge of the Boston office when Conley was there. And it's disgusting. I mean, in the sense that, you know, these people come in, they come in from another location, and basically Conley was running the office. You know, they deferred to him on so many things. He would bring them up to Billy Bulger's Senate President's office and show them around. And you know, back then too, the mindset was all about, you know, well, the mafia was the main target. And this notion, you know, he had this whole virulent set of organized crime gangs spread out in different parts of the city that in some cases were far more dangerous and violent than the people in the North End.
That's the context we should put it in. The reason this started was because the FBI was determined under J. Edgar Hoover that they were going to put an end to the Cosa Nostra, the mafia, the Italian mafia in the United States of America. And so the FBI was in a position to offer deals to gangsters to inform on the mob.
Top echelon informants.
Top echelon.
Yes, exactly. Right. And one of the things that was very weird to me about the Whitey Bulger case is Whitey Bulger was not trusted by the Italian mob in Boston, from everything I've read, and that most of the information about the Italian mob that went to the FBI was coming not from Whitey Bulger, but Stephen Fleming, although John Connolly, the corrupt FBI agent, doctored the books to look like he was getting more information from Whitey Bulger justify.
Right, he cribbed from other informant files and attributed to
I've quoted this many times, but John Connolly gave me one of his only interviews right before he was indicted, and he said, "We took down the mafia with a gang of two," meaning Whitey Bulger and Stephen Fleming. And he still believes that.
Let's take another call. Paul from Milton, you're on with me and Emily and Peter Galsinis from The Herald. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Again, this is maybe an old chestnut with me, but it seems like I'm wondering whether this was just, again, a tribal warfare affair, and Peter from South Boston would know that. You know that this was the Irish against the Italians. And we have really the Irish mafia here, which we can see has been much more deadly to just, you know, people who weren't connected in any way to it than the other mob was. Not to justify one versus the other, but Peter.
Well, no, I think
Robin Hood thing is an
right. But I think that's where the FBI comes in here. I think the FBI was. I think, in a sense, you know, both situations, both the Irish mafia, if you will, for lack of a better term, and the Italian mafia kind of existed in, you know, separate worlds. I don't think before this, you know, they you know, wanted to necessarily tangle with each other and start out. I mean, let's face it, the gang wars of the 60s were essentially Irish upon Irish. You know, it was Charlestown, Somerville. You know, they were racking up bodies, more than 60 bodies over that period of time. And the mafia was basically standing by on the sidelines. I think it was the FBI that basically said to, and the FBI in the form of somebody like Connolly, not only Connolly, though, you had Dennis Condon, you had Rico.
Other agents.
You had other agents before him, who basically understood that you could play them off against each other. And for the purposes, as far as the FBI was concerned, of their own individual advancement. And that's where Connolly comes in.
But
you know?
Peter, we had powerful journalists, and it were two people from The Herald, but they were in the Boston Globe, that perpetuated this myth about Whitey Bulger being this Robin Hood, taking from the rich, giving to the poor, scored in the old ladies' home with their groceries and all that kind of stuff.
Mean,
that went on for quite some time and gave credence to this.
Well, you couldn't even, I've said this before, but Paul Corsetti and I did a story on Louis Lydiff.
Paul Corsetti, reporter for The Herald.
Yeah, the late Paul Corsetti, back in 81. And, you know, the editors were very leery about even making the connection that Billy was his brother. And you had, when you identified him, when you identified Whitey, you had to have this long qualifier about the fact that, you know, according to a federal government report, organized crime report that labeled him a mobster, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, they were very, it was the evolution of him becoming a public figure, but it was still very shadowy. I mean, law enforcement was well aware of who he was and stuff, but not so much
Corsetti
the general public.
Wrote those stories in the Boston Herald about the situation. Yeah. He was at a bar room one night when a gentleman came up to him, Peter Galsinis, and what did that gentleman say, and who was he?
Yeah, Paul was a seasoned, Paul and his father, his dad, Eddie, were seasoned crime reporters, years and years of experience, and Paul had been given a tip. We were doing the story. He had been given a tip that he was going to meet somebody. Somebody said, "Meet me at this bar." And so he shows up, and he's waiting, and he's looking around, and this guy comes up to him and says, "You know, you're Paul Corsetti, right?" And Corsetti had been on TV in regards to a First Amendment case.
He'd the jail
been
thing, yeah.
Right. And Corsetti says, "Yeah." And the guy says, "How's that case going?" He says, "It's going all right." And meanwhile, Paul is looking past this guy to try to see who he's really looking for. The guy says, "Do you know who I am?" He says, "No." He says, "I'm Whitey Bulger, blankety blank." And never threatens him directly. What he did was he told him the make, model of his car, the license plate, and the name of the daycare center in Medford or Malden, I think it was, where his then wife dropped their daughter off.
Whitey Bulger says to Paul Chris today, we know the make and model of your car and where your little girl goes to daycare. Okay, let's take one more call here. Jeannie from New Hampshire, you're on with Emily, me, and Peter Galzinis from the Herald.
Hey, great show. You guys were talking about the FBI.
Yes.
And I'm thinking about the guy, Ibrahim Tadashev, that was friendly with Tamerlan, and the FBI went in, and he was unarmed. First they said he was armed, then he wasn't. He shot to death, and the FBI isn't releasing any info.
No. In fact, the father just had a press conference, Jeannie. Jeannie, we should say that.
Yeah, you should hold on, because we're going to be talking to the reporter that covered the press conference near the bottom of the hour, about 1:20 or so.
They released photographs too, Marjorie. I'm just looking at
them. Yeah, they released the photographs. We're going to have a lot more about the FBI and what
but
they have not said about the killing of Tardashev in just a couple of minutes.
I mean, it's the fox guarding the hen house.
It's the fox guarding the hen house.
Again. And how can we, you know, when I was a kid, there was the FBI show on TV. We all looked up to the FBI. But it seems to me, the more this stuff comes to light, they're just as corrupt as every other.
Well, what about killing that 16-year-old, that guy who kidnapped the 16-year-old? Now, as Marjorie says,
I would have shot
him
okay
too. With me. But
because
he killed the mother and the little boy.
But
don't you want? Did they have to kill him? Let's
well,
get
they didn't
him.
Have to kill him. But I don't feel so bad for that situation.
I know, but that's another case where the FBI is investigating itself.
Well, Jeannie, hang on. We're also going to talk to the guy that used to run the state police, Chase Whitey Bulger, for 20 years. He doesn't think much of the FBI either. We'll be talking to him in a few minutes. So hang on.
All right.
Peter Galzinis from the Boston Herald. Great work on Whitey Bulger. I'm glad for your sake. The case is over. Thank you for being with us.
At least for,
it's over. But as you know, Marjorie, we cannot get enough.
We cannot. Well, we're going to keep talking.
We're going to keep going with that. More on Whitey Bulger next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Secure your tickets to the Moth Main Stage Show live at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on October 17th.
I had the kind of parents who were late. That's what they were.
Last year, this event sold out, but the Wilbur Theater has set aside a limited number of seats for WGBH members. Support Boston Public Radio with a gift of $180, and we'll say thanks with a pair of tickets. Visit WGBHnews.org.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney is here with me. She's filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. We're going to keep talking about Whitey Bulger for another few minutes because he does face another legal battle, and that's his appeal. What will he say in a sentencing hearing? What will be the centerpiece of that appeal? Joining us to mull over the next act in the Whitey Bulger saga is David Frank, managing editor of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. He's been at the Bulger trial since day one. David Frank, thank you very much for being with us.
David, we're so jealous you've had that front and center seat.
Hey. I know, and Emily, I know that you have heard me say it many times. What a crime that there weren't cameras in that courtroom.
We say it every second. Awful.
We have to do a crusade because it's disgraceful.
I may quit my job and just focus on this.
Unfortunately, we have to go to Washington to change it because that's the Supreme Court rule, and it's just a travesty because what happened during that case, you wouldn't believe it unless you saw it. Mm-hmm. I do feel lucky that I saw it.
Well, before we get to the appeal, David Frank, I want to talk about Whitey is apparently lined up to do an interview with 60 Minutes. He's got this window of opportunity before he's sentenced, before he's moved into a federal system. It's a county jail he's in because, as you remember, Mitt Romney took away the right for anybody to bring a camera into a jail and interview a prisoner. So in the state, a state prison anyway. So this is a county prison.
Right.
I mean, would he do it? Would he want to do this before his sentencing? Is this his moment of opportunity because he didn't testify?
Well, yeah, I think he absolutely would want to do it. There's nothing legally that could really hurt him. If he says nothing or if he talks from now until his sentencing in November, he's going to get a life sentence. He will never walk outside of a prison cell. he certainly wants to tell his story. I've heard the same stuff that you've heard about 60 Minutes. There's been a lot of talk behind the scenes about Bulger doing an interview. It's not going to be easy. Even if Bulger signs off on it, and obviously 60 Minutes is interested, it's not going to be as easy as just getting up there and doing the interview. You're right that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen before he goes to a different facility. But I'll see it when I believe it, because I think it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I would think they throw all kinds of roadblocks up at this. That the feds
and we know that the prosecution they don't want him talking. They if he was going to talk, they wanted it to be in the courtroom when he could be cross-examined. So I don't think it's going to be as simple as Whitey Bulger just telling 60 Minutes that he'll talk.
Well, you know, you do think, David Frank from Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, I mean, Whitey Bulger is going to be, I believe, 84 years old in September.
Yep.
He's not a young guy. So, I mean, how long, if he does make an appeal and he talks about how he wasn't allowed to give his immunity defense, what kind of time frame are we talking?
It's a couple of years, Marjorie, because you've got to get a transcript prepared before the lawyers can even sit down and start writing the brief that would be filed before the First Circuit. Once the briefs are filed, then it needs to be scheduled before the First Circuit. The fact that he would be in custody serving a sentence would move it to the top of the line, but it's certainly a number of years. And it's worth noting, and it's kind of a quirk in the law, but in the event that Whitey Bulger were to pass away before the First Circuit had a chance to make a ruling, he would technically die innocent of the charges that he was just convicted on. Until the First Circuit makes a ruling, Bulger, if he passed away, I know it's kind of a somber concept. But
well,
he would
not to some people.
Yeah, well, not only as someone who covers the law do I even know that that's the case. But
yeah.
If you remember, like when John Salvi was murdered in prison.
He's the shooter at the abortion shootings back in the early 1990s, killed people at clinics in Brookline.
Right, and because the appeals court, the Supreme Judicial Court, hadn't decided his appeal yet, when he died, he essentially died an innocent man. He was not,
I remember that,
not considered convicted of the crime.
Hey, David, we were hearing rumors that while this is not normal in a federal case, that they were going to allow some victim impact statements at sentencing. Have you heard anything about that?
I think it will happen. I mean, we saw it happen even with Catherine Gregg, the Whitey Bulger's girlfriend, who pled guilty last year and got 8 years in prison in front of Judge Woodlock. The judge there allowed many victims to give impact statements. I actually was surprised at that one because it was debatable whether they were really victims of that particular crime. But I don't think there's any question that that Judge Casper will allow some members of the victims' families to speak at sentencing. And Whitey Bulger himself will have the opportunity, if he so chooses, to address the court at sentencing. And I think he'll say something.
David Frank, what about the families of the people whose murders were not proved? For example, Connie Leonard, her father was gunned down, murdered, shot in the head. The crime was not proved. The jury did not feel the government proved that case. So does she get to testify? Are those other people or only those whose murders were deemed proved by the jury?
That's going to be a really tricky one. I think from a purely legal standpoint, the answer is no, they would not get the opportunity to address the court. But part of it would depend on what the defense would say. I mean, if the defense objected to something like that happening, I think it would be very difficult for Judge Casper to let them speak. But, you know, one of the phenomenons of this case, and it still hasn't fully sunk in yet for me because it's still so new, but one of the phenomenons of this entire trial was that members of the victims' families actually started thanking the defense lawyer.
I know, we couldn't get over
information
it.
Out. And so to your question, would it shock me if Jay Carney and Hank Brennan ended up agreeing and saying to the people like you just mentioned, whose families were not, where the cases weren't deemed proved? He may not even object to it. And then, you know, the question would be whether the government would want to do it and whether the judge would allow it.
So there's the little matter of this $822,000 that was stuffed in the wall of the apartment. Those pictures are dramatic, by
Santa
the way.
Monica.
It's so neatly stacked and wrapped. Saran wrap with tape
well,
around it.
He was
it.
A neat freak, was
wow.
he not?
Yeah.
Well,
anyway, I couldn't believe that they were
that way.
I couldn't believe that they were dealing with that in court. I mean, I guess I would prefer that they would do it in an open manner, but how are they going to determine
who is, I mean, the federal government deems it's theirs. Anthony Cardinale is saying his client, Julie Dahmers, who was part of that extortion scheme over the liquor store, that she should get some of it. Some of the victims' families have been mentioned as recipients. How are they going to figure that out?
Well, Emily, it's going to get really messy. The first thing that has to happen is the judge has to make a finding that that money was the result of criminal activity. That's not going to be an issue. She certainly will do that. And then it's almost a race to the courthouse. The judge will look at a number of different victims, and you mentioned Tony Cardinale, who already has a lien. I think it was Judge William Young, one of the other federal judges there, who granted it to him. There will be a decision that has to be made ultimately by the federal government about how that money gets distributed. But it's going to get really messy. And the other issue, beyond the $800,000 that was found in California, if the federal prosecutors can get their hands on any other assets or any other items of value that Bolger has in his possession, they can try to seize that as well. And we heard about the ring from Chris Nyland. I mean, I imagine that's worth a few bucks. And if certain steps can be met in court, the government's going to try to get their hands on that ring as well, even notwithstanding the agreement that we entered into by the prosecution and the defense yesterday.
That he was going to, they were going to allow Whitey Bulger to keep it. He can't wear it in prison. Why does he want it?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to let him wear it. But the issue, though, is...
Chris Nyland was married to Teresa Stanley's daughter? Teresa Stanley's daughter, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the issue, I mean, if it's a pure gift, then Bulger can go into court and say that it is not the result of any sort of criminal activity or criminal endeavors, and therefore try to keep it exempt. But if the prosecution can somehow show that that's not the case, if Chris Nyland hypothetically submitted an affidavit saying, I never gave that ring to Whitey Bulger, that's going to make an already messy situation even messier. So it is certainly not the story of the day when you think about what the jury decided yesterday, but that will be litigated down the road in this case.
We're talking with David Frank, managing editor of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, who's had a front row seat in the courtroom for these many weeks of the Whitey Bulger trial. You know, I wonder, David, Patricia Donahue, of course, is the widow of Michael Donahue. He was a truck driver, totally innocent guy, whose big mistake was giving a ride home to this guy they repeatedly call Balloon Head in the trial, who was murdered.
Brian Halloran.
Brian Halloran was murdered by Bulger and his associates. Anyway, the Donahues have said they want to pursue a civil suit against the government for keep allowing Bulger to keep operating as an informant while he was killing all these people. One down, one to go is what Tommy Donahue said outside the courthouse yesterday. Is there any chance the Donahues have been turned down at every point, saying they were too late for a civil suit? Is there any chance of their getting anywhere with a civil suit to sue the government at this point?
I don't think so. I mean, I've talked to Tom and talked to the Donahue family. They're going to try. There's no question about it. But a lot of the issues in terms of the statute of limitations were litigated before the First Circuit. I'm trying my best not to sound too much like a lawyer because this stuff can get really complicated. But it's worth anyone out there who wants to get sort of their hands around this whole idea that the government in the civil court basically told a number of families, including the Donahues, that they should have filed earlier. They should have basically been reading the newspapers and watching TV and listening to the radio.
It's incredible.
They should have known what was happening earlier and filed their lawsuit earlier. And because they didn't, the door to the courtroom got shut. And again, some of this legal stuff can get really dense, but if you look at the opinion that came out of the First Circuit, there was a dissenting judge who basically just went off on the majority of the majority decision in the case and went off on the federal prosecutors for doing what they did to these families. It's crazy. I'm actually down in the Cape right now, so I don't have it in front of me, but when you read that decision, you walk away really understanding how dark and disturbing this whole thing is on so many different levels.
Hey, David, just one last thing quickly. Where is Whitey going to end up doing his time? He's going to be in some federal prison. It's not going to be a club fed. Where's he going to go?
Well, you know what, Emily? It's a million-dollar question, because if Oklahoma and Florida weren't lurking, and I think Oklahoma is much more likely.
Indiana?
He'd go to Indiana. Colorado is not exactly a I don't believe they have tea times at that facility. I mean, look, the reality is this guy is, you know, going to be 84 years old in September. He is not going to be in a comfortable setting. We, you know, Steve Fleming testified to the prison settings that he's living in, and there was talk about barbecues on July 4th. It is not going to be that kind of a setting, no. But where it is, I don't know at this point.
We're anxious to hear.
We'll know in November.
All right. David Frank, managing editor of Lawyers Weekly. He's been covering the trial since the beginning. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you, David.
Anytime. Have a good day.
All right, from the Whitey Bulger trial, and another angle. That's through the eyes of Tom Foley, the retired state police colonel. The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you are just tuning in, we are spending a good part of the day going over the Whitey Bulger verdict yesterday. And joining us on the line is a man who spent 15 years, or even 20 years, chasing Whitey Bulger. That's retired State Police Colonel Tom Foley, who wrote about his experience in his book, Most Wanted. I saw Tom Foley yesterday, and he chastised me for not having read Most Wanted. I downloaded
it
on my iPad last night. I'm reading it now. Tom Foley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Hey, Tom, it's Emily Rooney. We were wondering why you weren't part of the victorious scrum yesterday. Our sources on the scene say you were standing off to the side and you weren't kind of among the people who were slapping each other on the back. I mean, after all, you were head of the state police at the time.
I wasn't invited.
Ah, that's a good answer.
Well, you know, you told me yesterday when I did see you down there and you chastised me about the book that that you were not sure that the policies have been put in place by the FBI for preventing what happened again. I mean, for preventing what just happened with Whitey Bulger from happening again vis-a-vis informants and making these deals with these criminals. That's pretty upsetting.
It's, you know, it's just the way it is. Unfortunately, I think that, you know, with us as a core group of investigators in the case, that's where a little bit of our frustration comes in because, you know, the ultimate goal naturally was to put Bulger in jail for the rest of his life. But, you know, if those policies weren't in place that the FBI was using with informants, then we wouldn't even have to dealt with Bulger or Fleming or that whole crew. You know, we would have went after them a long time ago and they would have been in jail and a lot of lives would have been saved. But, you know, it was that informant policy, that protection over the years that the FBI provided Bulger and Fleming that allowed them to flourish. And, you know, so, and I don't think, and, you know, that the message has really, you know, been delivered here. So, you know, just a year ago, we had a similar situation with Mark Rossetti, who was another FBI informant, and a similar situation as to his relationship with the FBI, same as Bulger.
I don't know about Mark Rossetti. Tell people.
Mark Rossetti was a capo or a captain in the LCN. And, you know, he got picked up last year on state police wiretaps. And for a long time, at his level, an upper-level individual in the LCN or the mafia, you know, that he was being operated by the FBI. And this guy had been involved in all kinds of...
Well, wasn't he the one from the suspect in the Gardner Museum heist?
Well, his name came up at one point. I'm not sure if that was, you know, anything legitimate, but, he's a drug dealer, a lot of arms violations, alleged to have committed some murders and so forth.
So he's pretty serious, and it's not over.
No, it's not over, and you know, when the informant policy, as a result of the Bulger case, was so-called changed by the feds in 2000, they said this wouldn't happen again. But, you know, it's just not here in Boston. That this is happening across the country. There's a, you know, there's an institutional way of for them to deal with this, these informants. It's standard throughout the country, and it's happened in other places, but, you know, they're just not getting the message here. You know, we're going to continue to have the Bulges and Flemmies out in these streets if these criminals at their level continue to be protected.
We're talking with Tom Foley, who ran the state police for many years in Massachusetts and chased after Whitey Bulger for many years, author of Most Wanted, about the Whitey Bulger case. You know, Tom, for people that don't know and haven't followed this case as closely, my understanding is, from your book and others, that every time the state police investigators were trying to gather evidence against Whitey Bulger, the targets, like Bulger and Flemmy, seemed to know, and Kevin, we seemed to know where and when to keep quiet and to get out of the cars and walk in fields because they knew that their conversations were being recorded. So give us an example of that. What happened?
I mean, it's happened numerous times, Marjorie, over the years, with DEA put a bug in there. In their car, and they were notified of it right away. I mean, this is all...
By the FBI, by John Connolly.
By the FBI. Yeah. John Connolly, in particular, was their handler. You know, John Connolly is another individual that, you know, we went to trial down in Miami with him in 2008 and 2009, and John's doing 40 years to life for his involvement in this case. But, you know, John wasn't the only individual that was part of this. You know, certainly supervisors weren't supervising... And there were other agents that were a part of this whole thing that it was more about protecting informants than it was getting the bad guys in public safety. And, you know, actually they were putting other law enforcement officers in jeopardy because we'd be putting bugs into certain places or serving search warrants.
Like where? Like where? Where were you putting bugs?
Oh, we had, you know,
Lancaster Street.
During this investigation, Lancaster Street was one of the early on investigations. We had bugs over at the Busy Bee. We had another bug over.
That's a restaurant in Brookline on Beacon Street? I've had ham and eggs there a million times. Who hung around there, Tom Foley?
If you really want to have good food, follow the wise guys. I know all the places to eat.
Who was hanging around there? Whitey Bulger was at the Busy Bee?
Yeah, well, Bulger wasn't there, but Flemmy was there.
Wow.
Frank Slemmy was there. Bobby DeLuca Capo. They used to go in there all the time. We actually bugged two of the booths in that restaurant, you know.
Wow, so, where else? Knew. Where else?
Well, there's another barbershop that was right across the street from there where they used to go into. We did wiretaps on Guzzy Sunoco. We had five payphones tapped down by the harbor that they used to use all the time. We were going full out in the early 90s with bugs and wiretaps all over the place. We couldn't keep up with it.
Hey, Tom.
But, you know, a lot of that's in the book, Marjorie.
Yeah,
I know. I just downloaded it.
I want to know.
But the thing is, they would realize these wiretaps were there, and then they would stop going into those phone books or the Busy Bee or the Sunoco station, et cetera, correct?
What was happening over those years were, at the time, my people that I work for and, you know, my bosses – and the FBI bosses were in communication, and oftentimes I would be told by my bosses, listen, you got to let the FBI know what you were doing out there, because they'd complain to the state police hierarchy that, you know, Foley and his crew, they're not telling us what's going on. And all that was, you know, they wanted to be able to protect Bulger and Flemmy. So, you know, I did used to tell the FBI certain things about what we were doing, but I didn't tell them everything. And those certain things I would tell them would be compromised. But we always had one or two things that we could continue to work on, continue building the case. You know, and we ended up getting there. We had two U.S. attorneys that wanted to do the right thing. Were working with us with Fred Wyshek and Brian Kelly in there, even against a lot of people in the U.S. attorney's office at the time, did not want to see Bulger and Flemmy prosecuted. So the political fight through this whole thing has been more exhausting and probably, you know, taxing on us than actually going after Bulger and Flemmy, you know. So, you know, and yesterday was a little bit of that. You had a lot of people standing up there talking that, you know, do not know the history of this case. And if you don't know the history of this case, then you're not going to learn from it. And that's kind of what we're afraid of. You know, it's great to get this madman the devil off the street, don't get me wrong, and it's nice to give a little comfort to the families that are involved, but you just don't want to see something like this happening again, and, you know, I'm afraid it's going to.
Talking to the retired head of the Massachusetts State Police, Tom Foley. Tom, you testified on day two of the trial. What was that like?
Well, it was it was something that I never thought I'd get there. I never thought with this investigation for a long time. I thought we were going to be able to find him, before 16 years went by. But it was an opportunity to now say finally, okay, these are the last steps. We can get this guy and pull him off the street. So, I mean, it was satisfaction in that regard. But the whole case is nothing came easy in this case, even towards the end with the jury, and how they were, taking some time. And actually, I think the jury did a pretty good job. But, nothing for us. It was the internal struggles more than anything that, that happened over the years that really made this thing kind of taxing or frustrating for us.
Did you feel you were treated fairly by the cross-examination from J.W. Carney?
Actually, I had Brennan that was...
You had Brennan, Hank Brennan.
Yeah, but yeah, I did. I mean, there were some things I would have liked to have gotten into some more, but that's always the way it is when you're on the stand,
We're talking to retired State Police Colonel Tom Foley. One last thing for me, Tom. Despite all these wiretaps and the tip-offs and Whitey Bulger being able to circumvent them with Flemmy and his cohorts, you were about to arrest Whitey Bulger back in 1995 before he fled. But what happened?
Well, actually, what was going to happen, we had the indictment. It was a very, small indictment on these guys, but it was the first time that we were going to be able to put them in jail. And, initially the U.S. Attorney's Office decided, and they told us in December of 94, listen, we're going to wait and put on a stronger case in the spring, and we're going to move on it then. And that was at the behest of the FBI. And, I said to the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time that, the state police's official opinion is going to, public opinion is going to be out there that you had the opportunity to indict and you didn't. And we just felt that even if we could just get a little bit of a grasp on these guys, then that would have taken down the air out there that these guys were untouchable and would open up maybe some more people willing to come in and testify. And that was what we were trying to do. And, but I was told, okay, we'll move forward. We will indict them, but the FBI has to be part of it. And part of it would be that they would be responsible for the arrest that night. They were responsible for Bulger. We took Flemmy, and we arrested Flemmy. They took Bulger, and it was 16 years later before
we
saw him. So,
because he was tipped off by John Conley.
On the lam.
Tom Foley, great stuff.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for joining us. And you can read more about all of this in Tom Foley's book, Most Wanted. Speaking of Most Wanted, Marjorie, another one of our most favorite stories because it's so interesting. We're going to take a look at that FBI investigation into the shooting of Ibrahim Todashev. His father had a press conference this morning. He was the kid who was killed while the Boston-based FBI agent was interrogating him. We'll have more on that just coming up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm James Edwards. I live here in Brighton, and I report here in Boston. Well, I do this because of the accountability.
The chamber's salary is far and away the highest in the state. And I would say that one of the reasons for that is that it is the largest, probably most complex, urbanized environment in the state that has a city manager form of government.
Me sticking with journalism is sort of the work and kind of that sense of public good in a way. James Edwards, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Old Sturbridge Village, where kids can get free admission in August and families can explore an early New England village with costumed historians, farm animals, and more than 40 antique buildings. Details at osv.org. And Frontline, high school football has a high profile with nationally televised games and big sponsors, but is enough being done to ensure player safety? Watch Frontline, Football High, Tuesday at 10 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Emily Rooney is here filling in for Jim Browdy. Okay, this morning about 11, the father of Ibrahim Todashev held a press conference about his son's fatal shooting during an FBI investigation. The FBI is on the hot seat, I guess, today, Emily. Joining us on the line from Orlando, Florida, where Todashev last lived and where the press conference was held, is Bobby O'Brien, a reporter for WUSF Public Media. Bobby, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome. And just one slight correction, I'm actually in Tampa, Florida.
Oh, you're in Tampa, sorry.
Yes, that's where the press conference was held.
So what happened?
Well, there was certainly a crush of media, and there were plenty of people there from Orlando. There were several attorneys, and the father of Ibrahim was there, and he spoke for about 5 minutes through an interpreter. They said they wanted three things to come across in the press conference. Number one, to announce that there was a new legal team, not a new, but enhanced legal team. Number two, that they were behind the investigation that's currently underway by the Orange County State Attorney. They back it fully and want to cooperate in any way. Number three, they wanted to introduce the father and let him talk about his son.
And he did, didn't he? He was talking about, he said things like he was a good boy, he wanted to live, he was a good grandson, he was a good neighbor. And the father choked up several times, and we understand.
Yes, he did. I was sitting less than 3 feet from him. There was a box of Kleenex next to him. He choked up when speaking, but you also saw him really react when they started putting up these posters of photographs of his son when he was a child, of him when he was with his kickboxing buddies at the gym. And he also provided a photo that he took from the apartment after the police let him back in that shows a very bloody entranceway.
Did they offer up a version of events or not?
Because that's the frustrating thing, that we don't know what happened. We don't have any information on the autopsy from the medical examiner.
Nope.
We don't have any. The FBI is investigating itself yet again, and I have a lot of questions about the FBI. Is there any indication, Bobby, that there is going to be some kind of outside look into this, or we're going to find out what happened to this young man?
Well, there is, and that's one of the reasons why they held the press conference. They mentioned the Justice Department, but also the state attorney for Orange and Osceola counties, Mr. Jeff Ashton, who has apparently last week said he was going to investigate the matter because it did happen in his jurisdiction. And they said that they had full faith that he is going to do an independent investigation. Therefore, all of the questions and speculation about what happened, was he shot 7 times? They had their own investigator who has told them some things, but they refused again and again to speculate because they said they want to hear it from the investigators.
We have a little sound here from the executive director of the Council on American and Islamic Relations in Florida on what their own investigation into the killing showed. Let's hear that.
We hired a homicide detective to examine the scene, and one of the things that we've confirmed is that only one officer, it was the FBI agent who shot all the bullets. And what the homicide detective's opinion was, because he worked for law enforcement for over 20 years, he said if there's a justifiable shooting, typically all the officers will draw their weapons. In this case, only one weapon was drawn.
Wow.
So, Bobby.
And you heard there was quickly stepping in was one of the attorneys who said that is, again, only speculation from a source that they said they could not name from within the investigation and labeled it speculation, and that really they do not know that for certain.
But this FBI isn't going to cooperate. I don't understand how they're going to get to the bottom of an investigation when the FBI is not going to cooperate. Wouldn't you want to debrief the officer who fired the shots? They're not going to talk.
Well, I'm not one to speak for the FBI, but I do know that a state attorney does have the force of law behind them. So they are the lead prosecutor for that region in Florida.
Bobby, one last question for me. I have read that the girlfriend, or at least friend of Todashev, who is in the country illegally, has been held since this shooting and is facing deportation. What's happening with her? Is she still being held, or what's the deal?
That subject did not come up, and I do not have any knowledge on that,
okay.
I'm sorry to say.
Okay, that's okay. That seemed to me a little bit, you almost wonder whether there was a overzealous pursuit of the young woman who was related to Tardashev as a friend or girlfriend, because she, of course, may have been a witness to what happened. And maybe, I mean, I'm speculating here, but you can speculate that perhaps they did not want to hear what this young woman had to say about what happened when this FBI investigator was in the room.
All right. Bobby O'Brien, reporter for WUSF Public Media in Florida, Tampa. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We also would like to point out that we have online at WGBH.org. Did I get that correctly? Yep. WGBH.org.
WGBHnews.org.
Thank you. I knew I was goofing something up. WGBHnews.org. The photographs of Mr. Tardashev. The father has said, of course, that his son was shot multiple times, once in the top of the head, raising the question, of course, if he was unarmed. Other people have said he was armed with a knife, or that he attacked them with a broom and all these other things. But
the photographs, I should point out, is just the aftermath. It's not of the body.
Yeah, but we have photographs of the aftermath. Okay, let's put it that way. And but you can certainly get the photographs online. And it does raise questions, which we don't have any answers to. And before we move on to a happier subject, here's some music. This is unbelievable. We have the FBI here in Boston. Everybody's talking about there should be an investigation into the FBI and the Whitey Bulger case. Doesn't seem like there's going to be one. Now we have the FBI down in Florida, I would say, covering up the circumstances of the killing
and
of this young man.
And I know you're not sympathetic, but why did they murder the guy who kidnapped that 16-year-old yesterday? We're not going to know anything about that either.
It's like a rogue operation. What happened to the Untouchables? Don't you remember Elliot Ness?
That's who they are.
I know. Well, that's a very good point. They are now the Untouchables.
All right, Marjorie. We're not going to leave this alone, are we? But
no.
But we're going to change the subject just for a few minutes. Something completely different. We're stepping out of the world of Crime and Punishment, listening. And we're going to be hearing from Edgar B. Herwick III and music critic Sarah Rodman. We're here to give us some new music suggestions. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Dalton, Georgia is a small factory town with a large Spanish-speaking workforce. The high school soccer team, all Latino, has a big reputation. It recently crushed a formidable team from Atlanta.
They were kind of in shock and awe. 15 minutes into the game, they'd given up more goals than they had all season.
A Georgia community now with deep Latino roots, next time on The World from PRI.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at DoverRug.com. And the law firm of Wolf Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolf Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney is here with me filling in for Jim Browdy, and joining us in studio for a much needed change of subject in Studio 3, we're going to talk about new music with Edgar B. Herwick III and Sarah Rodman from the Boston Globe, the TV and pop music critic there. Thanks, you guys. Thank you, guys. Excuse me. I sound
like
Whitey Bulger.
Let's all take a deep breath and talk about some music.
Let's talk about some music.
Should we put to the Whitey Bulger trial? No.
Soundtrack. Yeah. What is the soundtrack?
All right. Educate us. What do you guys got? I love
this
stuff.
Well, how do we want to get started? Well, I actually wanted to get started talking about some old music before we got into new music.
Okay, ready.
This is I wanted to pay tribute briefly to a guy named Cowboy Jack Clement. And he died late last week at the age of 82. And he had, you know, a somewhat of a recording career as an artist, but really his contribution to music was huge and behind the scenes, both as a songwriter and as a producer. And one of the things that he was responsible for example, was the career of Jerry Lee Lewis. He discovered him. He found Jerry Lee Lewis, and he was the first person to ever record Jerry Lee Lewis, which he did. He worked at Sun Records, which is this legendary early rock and roll studio down in the South. And while Sam Phillips, who he worked for, was like away for the weekend, he recorded Jerry Lee Lewis. And it turns out that Jerry Lee Lewis ends up being you know, an absolute star and very important in the development of rock and roll music. And then this guy goes on to write songs for everybody from Roy Orbison to Johnny Cash. Then he got involved in he was producer for people like Townes Van Zandt and Waylon Jennings and that cowboy outlaw movement.
Wow.
And then he even worked with U2 by the end of his career. He did some stuff with them on Rattle and Hum. But what I really wanted to point out is, you know, one of the most famous songs of all time, Ring of Fire, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this is really sort of demonstrative of how important sometimes producers are. So I have two cuts
They're
of Ring of
Fire. Very important.
I have two cuts of Ring of Fire. The first one is the first time it was recorded. Now, the song was written by Johnny Cash with some of the members of the Carter family. And one of the members of the Carter family recorded it before Johnny did, right? She put it out on one of her records. And the deal was Johnny Cash had basically said, like, he had another idea for how to record it. He said, you put your version out. If it's not a hit in 6 months, then I'm going to record it too. So she put it out. It was not a hit, even though they released it as a single. Let's listen to what it sounded like before Johnny Cash and Cowboy Jack Clement got their hands on it. Here's Ring of Fire.
Love is a burning thing. Desire, I fill in the ring of fire.
So it's a good song. You recognize it. Yeah.
It's
good.
Got a great voice.
But then what happens is Johnny Cash, the story goes, had a dream of horns. And according to Johnny Cash's biography, he called Cowboy Jack Clement because, quote, I knew he was the only one who'd see how we could make it work. There wasn't any point in even discussing the idea with anybody else. And then, of course, those horns were added. Because, you know, Johnny Cash had conceived it, and this Cowboy Jack Clement could pull it off. And here's Ring of Fire, how we know it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just iconic with those horns, that mariachi sound, the sound
Love
on the bass.
Is a burning thing.
And the thing is a huge hit. And it was huge for Johnny Cash because he had never ever recorded anything that sounded quite like this before.
Yeah, but it's his voice, too.
It is. And there's no question about it. It's not.
And the refrain when he does that ring, ring, ring. Nobody can do it like that.
Absolutely. But so I just wanted to take a moment and point out the work of Cowboy Jack Clement.
Tip our cap. I read his obituary. I didn't know that much about it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting. I mean, all of the, you know, these. It's also really. It points out how in the early days of rock and roll, you know. Country was a part of it. Rock and roll hadn't really figured itself out yet. R&B was a part, you know, like black music, white music. I mean, it was such a melting pot.
Did he make any money, Jack Clement, doing this, or was he just left?
He did. Yeah, he did. He was well known.
Good. All right, top that, Sarah.
All right, new music.
All right, I'm not sure if I can top that because that's quite an insane career. But I will shift gears to the Tedeschi Trucks Band. This is the band that is made up of Susan Tedeschi, who's a local here from Norwell, Massachusetts. Her family runs the Tedeschi Food Shops. She's a Grammy-winning sort of R&B and blues singer, and she's married to Derek Trucks, who is the guitar player in the Allman Brothers Band, and they have a band together. They have won a couple of Grammys as the Tedeschi Trucks Band. They have a new album coming out tomorrow called Made Up Mind, and I guess the song we have is Idle Wind.
Like a bird in a somber sky, just a ship with a sail in an idle wind.
So she's got that great raspy, like sexy sort of voice. And you don't hear flute that often in rock and roll. There's 11 people in the band, and you can hear it all. And I just wanted to play a little bit of a completely different sounding song from the same record called I Look Worried. Do I look worried? Do I look worried?
No, you don't.
Smacked in the face, such a disgrace, you were wrong. Try it again, stay till the end, but how long?
Just a huge fan of that sort of Bonnie Raitt-ish, soulful, from the gut kind of singing. She's also a really great guitar player, as is her husband, who's also toured with Eric Clapton and Bob Dylan. And the whole album is just like a real stew of like pop and rock and soul and country. And just like, it's really gutsy. It's their best record that they've made yet.
What's the name of the album?
It's called Made Up Mind.
Made Up Mind. Okay. And by the way, I should say these songs are all going to be posted on the WGBHnews.org website as well. You look for Boston Public Radio, that would be us. Made Up Mind, though, if you're just writing things down like me.
The Tedeschi Trucks Band. Edgar, it's all you.
Love it. Well, I'm going to stick with a female vocalist and another artist who, for me, like, I think the vocals are a real standout. And this is somebody called Alila Diane, who's been around for a few years now. I think the first record that really did anything was in 2004, something called Pirate's Gospel. She's a great singer. And I want to give a plug here before we play a song for making mixtapes for your friends, because that is probably the best way for music discovery. And this is somebody that I learned about because I had a friend who's really into music. She made me a mixtape, and this artist was on it. And since then, you know, this is an artist that I was able to follow. And it's a reminder to me that the best way to discover music is to talk to your friends who also love music and ask them to make you mixtapes and make mixtapes for them of stuff that you're listening to, because it's the best way to learn. So anyway, there's a new album that Alila Diane has coming out, which is called About Farewell. And the whole album centers around, sadly, the band that she was playing with. She was married to the guitar player. They have gone through a divorce, and this album is what came out of that divorce. It's a little bit more maybe heart-wrenching than some of the other stuff she's done, but very, very good. This is a tune called About Farewell. It's the title track.
It is plain to see that I have one foot out the door, and I know that your dear heart is telling you to run deep down somewhere, deep down somewhere. I heard somebody say that the brightest light cast the biggest shadow.
Can we get some tissues in here?
It's a bit of a dent, but it's beautiful, isn't it?
You know, I think divorces,
one foot out the door.
They make great music, don't they?
They really make great music. Actually, you know,
breakups,
I'd go back
tears.
Together after that.
I know.
Yeah. What's wrong with this guy?
Yeah. That man is kicking himself.
Yeah, really.
He wants to be a part of that record. Well, I'm just going to keep the sad train rolling.
Let's do it. It is gray outside, and we...
Yeah.
This is the next tune comes from the Civil Wars, who have this sort of really excellent backstory. That this country music duo, sort of country folk Appalachian sound, they hit really big in 2011 with an album called Barton Hollow. They were sort of one of the first people on the sort of folk rock train that, you know, Mumford and Sons and the Lumineers and all those other people sort of went along with them. And then they're both married to other people. But their records are really infused with this really sort of sexy chemistry. Somewhere along the way, they stop getting along for whatever reason, and they quit their tour in the middle of their tour for reasons of internal discord and imbalance of ambition was the reason that they put
out.
Imbalance of ambition.
Yeah,
wow.
Which is very interesting. Wow. And she had a baby. It's a male-female duo, like in the middle, like prior to the tour. The biggest tour of their career. They had done one Grammy's, done really well. So they broke up, but they decided to make a record anyway. And so...
Very Fleetwood Mac of them.
Yeah. And now they're not speaking to each other at all.
I love that they're called Civil Wars, right? I mean, they presaged this by naming them.
Maybe they had a torrid affair and then it didn't go well.
They're both married to other people and she's married to their man.
It didn't stop Anthony Weiner. Yeah. I mean, he was right in there.
Or any of the people in Fleetwood Mac.
That's right. Were they all having sex with each other in Fleetwood Mac?
I think John and Chris and me, we were only having sex with each other, but all the rest of them were.
Oh, okay. Well, why not?
Exactly.
Only young ones.
Exactly.
They're pretty old.
This song.
They are
go ahead. Let's hear it.
Yeah, they are.
So this is, there are both very up-tempo and gritty rocking songs on this record, but I tend to prefer the very sad melancholy ones, and this one is called Eavesdrop.
I don't want to talk right now. I just want your arms wrapped around me and this moment before it runs out. Oh, don't say that it's so.
sad
music. I love it. I love these
sad things. For all of the drama you're talking about, though, like, they really work together as artists.
And the
voices
blend.
You hear that, it's just perfect blend.
Yeah. But you need this kind of music, you know, because people are going through breakups all the time. You can sit in your pajamas, like in that great movie that we, Bridget Jones' Diary, you know, when she sat there in her pajamas, swilling the wine. Eating her Haagen-Dazs.
Stewing in desperate and sad music. It's so good.
You need music like this.
Oh, my God.
Stewing, don't you?
Absolutely.
And it makes you feel better about your own life, right?
Exactly.
Like, at least we don't have it as bad as these poor slugs.
That's right.
These poor rich slugs.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. So let's pick it up a little bit. All right. So I'm going to go with this is a recommendation of a band called Typhoon. And this is a huge band. And when I say huge, I mean there are many, many people in the band, upwards of 15, 16 people. Usually when they play live, it's somewhere in the 10 to 14 category. They're from Portland, Oregon, which is, you know, the home of the collective, right? Like, just like it seems like people all live in collectives and the bands are all collectives. This is the Pacific Northwest for you. So but it's all centered around this guy named Kyle Morton. He's sort of at the center of this. And they got a new record, which is coming out, I think, tomorrow. But you can certainly find most of the tracks of this record online right now. And here's a little bit of the huge sound, very large sound of Typhoon with a track called Dreams of Cannibalism.
Unhand me, I am not a criminal, but I've played a guilty part. In the modern sense that one pretends the love is original. I wrote a book and I will call it something cynical. The story's slow, the hero does not change.
And a little bit of the Shins, maybe.
Yeah, a little Shins, maybe a little Arcade Fire.
Maybe some, like, weird, bizarro world Beach Boys kind of.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot.
Older sound.
Yeah.
You know, you said you get tons of, because you do this as a sidelight, you love music, but it's not your total career.
That's right.
It is at least a big part of your career, Sarah Robin. So you get your music from friends, Edgar B. Hoyt.
That's one place.
One place. Okay. Yeah. What you must get.
I get it from everywhere.
You get it from everywhere.
So, I get it from people on the street. They walk up to me and hand me CDs.
Really?
I get it from record companies. I get it from friends, too. I mean, there's so much music out there, so much music more than when we were younger people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that we're old now, of course.
Yeah. But, speak for yourself.
But the volume has exploded because you can do so much of it on your own now and just put it online.
So how do you manage that? Because you have to spend 90 hours a week listening to this stuff.
I just listen to what I can and, you know, try and make recommendations based on what I like and then take recommendations from other people.
Yeah.
From things that I read, from Edgar, from coming here. Almost every time I come here, the stuff that Edgar plays, I'm like, yes, I'm on board with that.
And you must get tons of emails recommending stuff as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. It's a high-class problem to have, though.
Yeah.
People sending you good music.
Yeah, no kidding.
But imagine, Emily, if you had everything else to get solicitations about music. I mean, I'd just be buried. Yeah. I'd never get up.
No.
I
wouldn't listen to it.
Well, you can't listen to it all.
Yeah.
I heard that.
You have to curate.
Well, it's like,
I already
it's
have
like
a copy.
Everybody's their own individual kind of record company and R-man now, right? So you imagine, you hear stories like in the old days that when people were like submitting tapes and the guy who's basically in charge of deciding whether they're going to sign a band or not, he'll listen for 30 seconds and make a decision right away whether he likes them or not. And sort of as a regular listener, that's how every single person
we
is now.
Do.
If you're on Spotify or iTunes or you're on some blog where there's 500 MP3s right at your fingertips, if you don't like something, almost immediately, it's very easy to move on to the next thing.
Well,
my
daughter's
good
at this too. She's got an ear.
But that's
I have an ear.
You do.
I do.
You have great musical taste.
What is that to her? When it was, you know, like when Mumford and Sons
when your
first
kids
came
play
out,
stuff.
I said, "What is that? That's good."
Mumford and Sons.
That was 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Thank God for the children. Otherwise, I'd be totally and completely out of it. Okay, Edgar B. Hoyt the III. Give us your next choice.
I think it's Sarah's turn.
Oh, it's Sarah's turn. I'm sorry.
It's okay. And I'm picking up the tempo a little bit too. But staying in a somewhat similar vein to the stuff that I played before, this is a new artist named Valerie June. And she's new in the sense that she's been around for 10 years and making records on her own and sort of toiling. And this is her sort of first big release. She's stealing from my wonderful colleague James Reed, saying to us she sounds like Erykah Badu channeling Dolly Parton. It's this
I'm in already.
I know,
right? You had me at Erykah Badu, actually.
It's really, she's, you know, she's from Tennessee. She's African American. She has dreadlocks. I don't know. Maybe I feel a kinship, whatever. And but she just has this really great combinations of the stuff that's happening now, the roots music, the Appalachian folk, the country, but also with an R&B and blues vibe to it, too. And her album is out now, and this song is called You Can't Be Told.
June.
So her name,
it's actually a really accurate description. That Erykah Badu Dolly Parton thing is pretty accurate.
Yeah, so it's Valerie June. She's one of those people with two first names as a name, Valerie June. And and she's been around for a while. If you recognize, talking about producers, not recognize necessarily, but if you have a sense that you've heard that sound before, Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys co-produced this album. And I feel like it's the first recommendation for somebody, if you know somebody who likes Alabama Shakes, that this is something that they would really enjoy. It's not as sort of gritty and dirty as that sound is. It's a little folkier. It's a little staxier, but it's really, like, soulful.
You know,
and
we had
exciting.
Christopher Lydon here last Thursday talking about that 20 Feet from Start on the movie, about
yes,
the backup singers,
absolutely,
which is a great movie.
So
but
good.
They made this very depressing point at the end of the movie that backup singers are kind of out of business now because there's so much more computerization of the music.
Right. And so many people multi-track their own vocals. If you are a good singer to begin with, you can just sing all the parts yourself. But, I mean, they're still needed in a live performance situation.
Okay.
So there's still plenty of people that want live backup singers on their records. I mean, in the R&B world and the country world, it's mostly in top 40 pop and like rhythmic top 40 where people are using
computers. Did you go to Justin Timberlake the other night?
I did.
I did too.
What did you think?
I didn't like it.
did you love Jay-Z?
I didn't like anything about it.
You didn't like any of it?
Forget it. I think this is going to sound ridiculous. I think I was too close.
Wow.
Actually, I can buy that, especially
because
if the whole thing's
the reverberations off the deep bass was hurting my body. So I was very
did you have earplugs?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
And I was uncomfortable physically because it was like
the
coming
bass
into my chest. And then at some point, it just all sounded the same to me. I mean,
being close
and
is actually
both
not
of them.
Ideal. I mean, being somewhere near the soundboard is actually the best place to sit at any concert because that's the person who's controlling the sound, and it sounds best in that spot to them.
I don't know. Fenway is not a great place, I don't think.
Sonically speaking, it is not ideal.
Too loud. I don't know. Yeah. It's not going to wind.
And sometimes
baseball
it's
stadiums
not
are not.
I couldn't believe the write-up in the Globe. I just couldn't believe it. We are over the top write-up. We are almost out of time here.
Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I enjoyed it.
All right, Edgar, we're running out of time here, so give us your last best pick here.
My last best pick. Let's go with a guy named Ty Segall. This is another thing kind of upbeat, despite the fact that he's writing this record after losing a father and being estranged from his mother. He's known for being like an electric shredder of a guitar player, but this is a little bit more of an acoustic album, kind of has a 70s vibe. This guy puts like four albums out a year, but they're most of them good. This is him opening the door to the studio.
I feel like I'm in a horror movie.
I think this is not what I expected it to be. From the same album, not the track I thought, but it is. It's very good. He's very good.
This is the link. This is the link you sent her.
I blame myself.
Okay,
for this.
He's blaming himself.
I love the way it sounds, though.
Oh my God, he's great.
Who's this again?
His name's Ty Segall. A little bit of an early Pink Floyd vibe, a little bit of a mid-70s vibe.
Okay, we are going out on this mid-70s vibe from Edgar B. Hoyt III, the man behind WGBH's Curiosity Desk, and Sarah Rodman, the TV and pop music critic for the Boston Globe. Thank you for being with us. Don't forget, all this stuff is on our website, this new music at wgbhnews.org. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic at 1 o'clock with Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe, and also a visit from New York Times reporter Mark Leibovich, who has just about eviscerated the shenanigans and greed in this town, New York.